This is going to be a an intro class on cosmological physics. And the reference that I'm following is the lecture notes by Daniel Bauman from a short course he gave at the University of Amsterdam. I'm sorry I don't have the link on hand, but if you Google it, it'll come up right away. I'll send it out after the class.
Their course website.
Oh, it is. Okay, great. No, you're one step ahead of me. And I think this is the best introductory reference for cosmology if you have more of a theoretical physics background and have seen GR before. I won't be able to cover the whole thing in 14 lectures, so I'll make some choices as we go. So I'm going to start by just talking about the geometric structure of space-time in the first lecture. So I'm just going to start by writing down a metric, which is the flat FRW metric, or Friedman, Robertson, Walker. And I'll just write it down at first as an ansatz, and then I'll explain in a little bit how it, the form follows from symmetry. In this expression, dx squared stands for the usual Euclidean metric on spatial coordinates x1 through x3. If you've seen cosmology before, you might notice that I'm writing down a simplified version of the FRW metric, which assumes spatial flatness. In a few lectures, I'll write down a more complicated version, which includes a spatial curvature parameter k. But I want to start with the simpler version. So just to just orient you a little bit, the function a of t here is just a free function of time, which is multiplying the space-space part of the metric. And just to orient you a bit to how that function behaves in our universe, for the first, I'll draw a picture. And the physics in this picture will come out of integrating the Einstein's equations, which I'll do probably in the next lecture. There's a brief initial period, where brief means around 10 to the 5 years, where this function a, I forgot to say, a of t is called the scale factor, since it scales the spatial part of the metric. So for the first 10 to the 5 years, the scale factor grows roughly as the square root of t. And this period in the universe's history is called radiation domination. And the universe during this time is dominated by, the stress energy is dominated by relativistic particles, or radiation. There then is a long period, around 10 to the 10 years, of matter domination, when the stress energy of the universe is dominated by non-relativistic particles, either dark matter particles or baryonic matter, like protons, neutrons, and electrons. The cosmologist, I'm hardwired to call an electron a baryon. I'm sorry about that.
Could the photon be written a bit bigger?
And during this time, the expansion rate picks up a little bit and goes as t to the 2/3. And then recently, the universe has switched over to being a cosmological constant dominated.
Kendrick?
Oh, yes.
Can you
write
a little
bigger? Oh, yeah, sure. Let me transplant this. Thanks. So for 10 to the 5 years, the scale factor, this is a of t as a function of t. The scale factor grows like t to the 1/2, and that's radiation domination. And then the expansion rate picks up a little bit and goes as t to the 2/3. That's matter domination. And then recently, after around 10 to the 10 years, the universe has switched over to being having stress energy dominated by a cosmological constant, during which time the expansion rate is exponential. It goes as e to the ht. We're here around 13 billion years after the Big Bang, where the scale factor is defined to be one by convention today. Okay. So that's just writing down the metric. And I'll start talking about the physics. So the first thing to point out is that this metric is spatially uniform. That, of course, is an approximation. The real universe is perturbed. Perturbations to uniformity are things like galaxies and other cosmological structures. And so this uniform description is just a coarse-grained description that applies on large scales. With that comment aside, the next thing I want to talk about are the symmetries of this metric. So there are some manifest symmetries are translation invariance, three translations, rotation invariance, three rotation. Now this metric for a general A of t does not have boost-like symmetries. So no boosts in general. If there are special cases, like if you take A of t to be constant, then the metric is Minkowski. And there are some less obvious special cases with enhanced symmetry, the De Sitter, anti-De Sitter, and Einstein static universes that I will talk about if there's time. But in general, this metric does not admit boost-like symmetries and does not admit time translation-like symmetries. I don't think this statement is totally obvious. Like, you can sort of convince yourself empirically by trying to construct boost-like symmetries, and you'll find that there's always some problem, like generating time-space terms in the metric. But that's not really a formal proof that if you're clever enough, you won't find an extra symmetry. But I'm going to omit it is possible to prove it formally, but I'm going to admit it. Omit that because it's a bit of a tangent. Just say proof of it. This statement that the FRW metric has these six symmetries actually has a converse, which is also a statement that I'll state but not prove. Translation plus rotational symmetry, properly defined, is enough to imply that the metric is FRW. For some choice of scale factor A of t, and possibly including spatial curvature in the metric, which I haven't written down yet. So the point is that this form of the metric is not something that appears out of nowhere. It's forced by the assumptions that if you assume that GR is the correct theory of gravity, and you assume that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, i.e. that there are no preferred locations or directions in the universe, which is empirically true as far as we can tell with telescopes. So the statement that there are no boost symmetry, no time translation symmetry, could be rephrased as saying that the universe has a global rest frame. No time translation symmetry. That means that the universe has a global clock. Those are really interesting statements. So to convince you that this is really true in our universe, just for fun, I'll talk about how you could directly measure the rest frame and the clock from observations of the cosmic microwave background. So the cosmic microwave background is the first approximation, a black body whose temperature, 2.726 Kelvin, is the same everywhere in the sky, regardless of which direction you point the detector. Yes?
So when you say global clock, should we picture this as like a, you know, absolute time, or what do you mean with global clock?
Oh yeah, so let me explain that a little bit. It takes a little bit to explain, I think. Imagine that you can make perfect observations of the CMB in any direction on the sky. The first thing you would see is a cosmic microwave background, which looks roughly isotropic, like it's 2.726 Kelvin in every direction. And then, as you make your detector a little bit more sensitive and dig down deeper into the noise, the next thing that you would notice is a CMB dipole. You'd see that the CMB isn't perfectly uniform, but it's a little hotter on one part of the sky than the other. And the magnitude of the dipole is around 3 millikelvin. Now, if you were to dig even further, you would find that there's anisotropy on top of this pattern at the 100 microkelvin level, which is what you've probably seen plotted if you've seen maps of the cosmic microwave background. It's been plotted after this monopole and dipole have been subtracted. The CMB monopole, or mean sky temperature, is a directly observable global clock. I haven't shown this yet, but it is true that because photons redshift with time, if we were to wait like 1 billion years and measure the CMB again, we would see a CMB temperature that was about 7% lower. By measuring this number, that's one direct way of measuring like the global clock of the universe, which is conceptually the same thing as like the total elapsed times. I'm just making the point that it's something you could appreciate directly from the CMB, that this really is a directly observable quantity. As for the rest frame, well, this dipole has the interesting property that if you were to observe the CMB from a boosted reference frame, that the dipole would transform like a vector. As a matter of fact, as the Earth orbits around the sun, the dipole actually changes by about 10% because of the Earth's orbital motion relative to the magnitude and direction of this dipole are a direct way of measuring like a cosmic speedometer. They tell you the motion of the Earth relative to the global rest frame, or the CMB rest frame is sometimes what people say. I'll use the term co-moving observer. Or an observer or a world line, which is at rest in the CMB rest
Kendrick,
Yes.
since the CMB didn't exist forever, how can we say that there is a global clock before the CMB then?
Yeah, I suppose that I wanted to make the statement that the global clock, or like the time coordinate that appears in the FRW metric, is like a directly observable. That is really only true if you're using this clock. It's only true if you measure it after the first 300,000 years.
Okay, so before that, in principle, there is no way of measuring, no practical way of measuring time.
There was still like a radiation bath with the same temperature as the CMB. The physics is a little different because it's coupled to a plasma. There are other clocks too, like in a universe with perturbations, you can use the amount of structure that's formed as a clock. The spatial coordinates which appear in the FRW metric, the FRW spatial coordinates, xi. Can be interpreted as labeling co-moving observers. In other words, a co-moving observer, their world line satisfies as constant coordinates in those coordinate values. And in this language of rest frames and clocks, the FRW time coordinate is the same thing as the elapsed proper time since the Big Bang. One really important thing to say that I forgot to say when I drew this picture is that the scale factor goes to zero, a finite amount of time in the past, because of this power law behavior. It doesn't go off as forever as an exponential or anything. For the expansion history of our universe, which depends on the contents, like the radiation and the matter, it is the case that if you run the clock a finite amount of time into the past, the scale factor goes to zero size, and that's the Big Bang. Okay. If I were to draw a space-time diagram in FRW coordinates, with time on this axis and the spatial coordinate on this axis, then the vertical lines would label co-moving observers. And the horizontal lines would label the clock. These are lines, these are the surfaces where the global time coordinate is constant. Now, to explain the meaning of the scale factor A of t, imagine that two co-moving observers, as represented by these vertical lines, were to measure the distance that separates them. Call that delta x physical. What they would get if they calculate their physical separation, to calculate their physical separation, they would use the FRW metric, which has the scale factor A of t multiplying the physical coordinates. And so they would get a factor of A of t times the coordinate distance separating them, which is constant in time if the observers are co-moving. And this is like the technical meaning of the statement that the universe is expanding. It means that if two co-moving observers, like say one of these is the Earth and we're measuring the distance to a faraway galaxy, which is also approximately co-moving, if we make that measurement at different times, we'll get an answer that increases with time as one power of the scale factor A of t. By the way, coordinate distances are sometimes called co-moving distances, and the FRW coordinates xi are sometimes called co-moving coordinates. And it's usually a lot more convenient to do calculations in co-moving coordinates and convert to physical distances in the end. So if I write a coordinate or a distance without a subscript, it means co-moving by default. And I'll always indicate physical quantities with a phys subset. A lot of getting used to cosmology is just figuring out where to stick factors of A of t. As an example, let's draw some light cones on this space-time diagram. I claim that erase some clutter here. I guess I'm just going to erase. I'll just start a new one. also claim that in the FRW geometry, light cones look like this. Here, the slope of the line here is dx over dt equals 1 over a. Not like this, as they would in Minkowski. One way to see that factor of a is to imagine, this light cone as observed by a local observer who makes measurements with physical rulers and clocks. A local observer would find that the physically measured speed of light along the light cone is always equal to 1. So they would write this equation. And then if I convert that to, I convert the physical distance to a co-moving distance, then I get the 1 power of a. Just for fun, another way to see this is to note that, generally speaking, in GR, nil geodesics satisfy ds squared equals 0. Like the squared length along the invariant length along the light cone is always equal to 0. And so if I just put in the form of the FRW metric here and rearrange, then I also get dx over dt equals 0. Makes an interesting change in the causal structure of space-time relative to Minkowski. Like, you'll notice that I drew the both the past and the future light cone as being finite. So in the future, the light cone would exponentially decay and asymptote to some constant radius, which would not be true in Minkowski. That comes from the exponential behavior of the scale factor. So it's not true in every FRW cosmology, but it's true in our cosmology. And so in our cosmology, both the size of the observable universe is finite, which is fairly intuitive if there's a big bang. But also the future light cone spans a finite radius. There's some finite co-moving part of the universe that we can never access along our future light cone. In fact, the picture here is sort of accurate in that for our cosmological parameters and our value of the clock, this size is something like 1/3 of this size. So there are galaxies on our past light cone that we can see with telescopes that even if we invent light speed travel tomorrow, we can never reach. They're outside of our future light cone. We just see them in our rearview mirror, but we can never get there. That's sort of sad. Okay. So I want to talk a little more quantitatively about geodesics. I'm going to integrate the GR geodesic equation and the FRW metric. I want to start by reviewing Christoffel symbols from GR. Now, the review may not be necessary since you've had a GR class already. But since you may have only seen GR for like 3 weeks, and it was back in January or February, I thought it might help to spend a few minutes refreshing everyone's memory. So let's talk about Christoffel symbols. So the way that I think about Christoffel symbols is that they arise when you take covariance derivatives of tensors. So let's write that out. I'm taking the covariant derivative of a tensor with m upper and n the lower indices. Then there's the partial derivative that you'd expect. And then there's one Christoffel term for each index. So for each upper index, you term like this. you can sort of follow your nose here. There's like only one way of contracting the indices with raised and lowered indices in the proper place. And Crystal, the sign of the Christoffel symbol is defined such that you get a plus, you get a positive term with an upper index and a minus sign when you're covariantly derivative, differentiating lower indices. Let's raise this board a bit. Yeah. There's a explicit formula for the Christoffel symbol. You want to calculate it as we will, as I'll calculate it shortly for the FRW metric. Here's what we did. And taken together, these two expressions have the magical property that the covariant derivative of a tensor, meaning that it transforms like a tensor under reparameterizations, is also a tensor in the sense that it also transforms tensorially under reparameterizations with the extra index. The covariant derivative of a scalar function is just the usual partial derivative. If you have more in this, you know, if you're differentiating a tensor, you get more terms. The second covariant derivative of a function is symmetric. So this is true. The symmetry holds if you're just considering second derivatives only, and the object that you're differentiating is a scalar without any indices. Otherwise, you would have curvature terms. I'll review curvature probably next time. And so this property of the covariant derivative is called torsion-free. It's actually not totally obvious from, you know, follow from these equations, but it follows after a little calculation with this form for the Christoffel symbol. Another thing that's true is that covariant derivatives of the metric are zero. Also true with the metric indices in the upper position. Sometimes this property sometimes goes by the name metric compatible. And this property is really important because otherwise the usual GR notation would have ambiguities. For example, if an expression like this appears in a calculation, then a priori you might interpret it two ways. You could say, well, do I raise this index first, the new index first, or do I take the covariant derivative first and raise the index at the end? And these expressions are equal. There's no notational ambiguity since these two right-hand sides differ by a term containing a covariant derivative of the metric. So this property of metric compatibility is kind of baked into the GR notation. My final comment is that this expression for the Christoffel symbol, if you want to derive it, it does follow from the torsion freeness and metric compatibility properties. Okay. And then last thing from GR that I want to review is the geodesic equation. So geodesic in GR is a path or some function where the coordinates in spacetime depend on a parameter lambda, such that the way I was going to write the equation was this way. Where this expression comes from geometrically is that if I define V, the four vector V, to be the four velocity along the path, then what I've written here is just the the closest thing you can write to the second derivative of x, which is covariant. It's the covariant derivative of the velocity field in the direction of the velocity vector. And so this implies one general property of geodesics is that the length of the velocity, or rather, the covariant version is conserved or constant. You can show that this follows from the geodesic equation. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition to be a geodesic. All right. Well, I'm not sure if that was too fast or too slow, but that was my 10-minute review of covariant derivatives and geodesics. Anyone want to ask any questions before I go on to effort? Yes, yes.
Not on this specifically, but just will you also give an outline of the course?
Oh, an outline of the course? Sure. Why don't I put that together for next time, or maybe I'll send it out over email. Roughly, I'm going to talk about first, I'll talk about the FRW metric and the geometry of spacetime. And then I'll talk about the thermal history of the universe, things like cosmic microwave background, cosmic neutrino background, dark matter freeze out, thermodynamic stuff like that. And then there'll be a little time left at the end. So I'll want to say something about the perturbations. And so I think I'll talk about the way the physics of by which perturbations are generated in the very early universe, during inflation, because that physics is really nice. I probably won't have time to talk about structure formation in the late universe, the way how the CMB is formed in detail, or how gravitational structures are formed at late times. Just because I could if there were a second cosmology course, but I think it would be too much for a 14 lecture course.
Maybe what about assignments and homework assignments and
I'll give a few problem sets, maybe three problem sets. I don't think I'll do separate tutorials. I kind of prefer just not separating problem sets from tutorials, but I'll keep the tutorial sessions Just in case and you guys like to just want space to work together on the problem sets or ask the TAs about the problem sets. Yeah, I just sort of dived in and started lecturing and didn't talk about any of that stuff. So thanks for asking. Okay. So after this, everything on the last like board and a half is just sort of a general review of geodesics and covariant derivatives in GR. Now I want to specialize this machinery to the FRW metric and figure out what geodesics look like in FRW. So I've already done that a little bit by plotting light cones, which are the trajectories of null geodesics or light massless particles. Integrating the geodesic in GR will give a little bit more information than this. For one thing, it will tell us what happens to massive particles or time-like geodesics. And even in the massless case, the trajectory, x mu of lambda, the lambda dependence contains a little more information than just the shape of the trajectory, because it tells you how the energy of the photon changes. So we're going to work both of those things out. This setup, and I imagine that we're solving for the trajectory of a particle with mass m. Greater than or equal to zero, just to emphasize that I'm going to be doing both the massless and massive case. And then one little thing that I swept under the rug is how you choose this affine parameter lambda that parameterizes the geodesic. The choice of lambda is, there's a rescaling freedom. And so I'm going to choose a convenient choice that will allow us to treat both the massive and massless case at the same time. Is to choose the affine parameter lambda so that the four velocity of the geodesic is the same thing as the covariant four momentum of the particle. The covariant four momentum. I'll always denote momenta by Q since I'll use P for pressure. The squared length of Q is minus m squared. With my sign convention for the metric, I'd like to put the minus sign in the time part. So this, I think, is the natural choice of parameterization for a massless particle. Or a massive particle. I just want to say that note that for a massive particle, an alternate choice would be to choose the affine parameter to be proper time, as experienced by the particle along the geodesic, in which case the squared velocity would equal minus one. And so my convention just differs from that by a factor of m. So for a massive particle, my lambda is proper time over m. Okay. Now, I promise I'm going to integrate the geodesic equation in just a minute. But first, I want to just comment on one subtlety. If for W metric, there's always some like powers of A to figure out. So first, let me just comment that using the symbol Q to be the covariant for momentum. And in particular, that means that if I were to write Q with the lowered index, then that would be A squared times Q with the upper index. Because I get a factor of A squared in the space components when I lower the index with the FRW metric. And so you might wonder, well, I sort of have two ways of defining momenta, or the spatial part of the momentum, that differ by a factor of A squared. So which one is like the physically measured momentum as measured by a particle detector in the FRW? Is it this or this, the difference by a factor of A squared, or something in between? And so the correct answer is this. It's sort of halfway in between. A quick way to see this is to write out in components this condition. Let me write it as something that bothers me a little bit about this derivation, but I'll just put it up. Keeping track of the powers of A which appear, you can see, oh, sorry, I got my signs wrong. This should be minus, this should be plus. You can see that this only makes sense if U0 is the physically measured energy, and AQI with the upper index on I is the physically measured momentum. I want the relation to just tell me that M squared is E squared minus Q squared, or E physical squared minus Q physical squared. So that's that argument is a little heuristic, but it's a very quick way to see that the physically measured momentum is related to is the same thing as AQ upper I, which is the same thing as A inverse Q lower I. If you find this argument a little too hand waving and would like a more pure math type argument, let me know after class. I prepped one, but when I got up here in front of the class, it seemed a little too pedantic. Personally, I find this one convincing. Okay. So now the goal is to integrate the geodesic equation. And the next step is to compute the Christoffel symbols in the FRW metric. So this is a great calculation if you're refreshing your memory in GR. I'll do half of it. So this calculation is going to break into different cases depending on whether these indices are time or space. So here's one of the cases. It'll work out. I'll do the case with two lower indices and two lower spatial indices and an upper time index. In this line, I'm just writing out the definition of This lambda. I'm gonna match the expression the way that I wrote it a couple blackboards ago. Yeah. Okay. So all I've done on this line is taken the general definition of the Christoffel symbol and just specialized the mu, nu, and rho indices to be spatial time. The lambda index here runs from 0 to 3, so it could be either a time index or a spatial index. Now in this next line, I'm just going to keep track of which terms are 0 or non-0. So I'll note that lambda here has to be a time index since d0i is equal to 0. This term then is 0 because lambda has to be equal to 0 and gj0 is 0. This term is 0 for the same reason. And then here I get something non-zero. In the next line, I'm plugging stuff in. This g0 is -1, and this term is minus the time derivative of a squared delta ij. The minus sign cancels. There's a factor of 2 that comes down, and the result is equal to AA dot delta ij. So I'll write the other Christoffel symbols down, the other cases down in a minute. But first, I want to introduce a quick definition. The way that I'm actually going to write this is a squared h delta ij, where I've defined h to be this function of time. And the function of time is called the Hubble expansion rate. It has units of inverse time, and it's just the fractional increase in scale factor per unit time. It sets like a basic cosmological scale. It's just a way of parameterizing the expansion rate of the universe. The modern measurements are roughly this. I'm going to quote values of the inverse Hubble expansion rate, which have units of time. These are not the units that you'll most commonly see, but I'll explain the weird astronomer units next time. The expansion rate of the universe, roughly, you wait a time on the order of 14 billion years, the universe will expand by some order one factor. And that's just the basic cosmological scale that appears all over the place. For example, the age of the universe, the time since the Big Bang, is some order one number times h naught inverse. And so are related things like the radius of the observable universe on the past light cone, or the size of the radius of the future observable universe on the future light cone. So many cosmological quantities are of order h naught or h naught inverse. Say it's like the most fundamental distance scale or time scale in cosmology. Okay. So I interrupted the Christoffel symbol calculation to sneak that definition in. Let me just summarize the way that the rest of the calculation would turn out. So the FRW Christoffel symbols given this. So the, where's this one that I calculated? This one? Well, I guess I forgot to say that the Christoffel symbol is symmetric in its lower two indices. That property is equivalent to the torsion-free property. That's why I'm not writing like gamma upper I lower J0 as a separate case. And then remaining Christoffel symbols are zero. You could either get all these zeros by brute force, or as a shortcut, you could notice that many of them vanish by symmetry. Because of the rotational symmetry, a Christoffel symbol with an even number of spatial indices has to, sorry, an odd number of spatial indices has to vanish. Whereas Christoffel symbols with an even number of spatial indices can have some rotational invariant right-hand side built out of delta. The Christoffel symbol with all zeros, you cannot conclude from rotation symmetry alone that that vanishes. But if you do the calculation, you'll see very quickly that it's equal to zero. Okay. 3 more minutes. I guess that is enough time to write down the solution to the GS equation. Okay. And now if I take the geodesic equation, I'll write it this way. I chose my normalization of the affine parameter so that U is the same thing as the four velocity of the geodesic. So I'll write the geodesic equation this way. And then plugging in the FRW Christoffel symbols that I calculated, I get this pair of equations. The case where mu equals zero will quicken. And the case where mu is a spatial index will fix this. There's a 2 here. Okay. There's a trick for integrating this very efficiently, which is to take the second equation and notice that if I plug in q0 equals dt d lambda, if I plug that into the second equation, then I can trade the lambda derivative for a time derivative and write the second equation this way. IDT plus 2H. Right. And send this up. If I write H as a dot over a. And I can integrate the equation by putting this on the left-hand side and this on the right-hand side. So that integrating both sides, I get log of q is minus 2 log a plus constant. Or exponentiating q is q upper a goes as a to the minus 2. Or equivalently, the physically measured momentum along the geodesic goes as a q upper is proportional to a to the minus 1. I'll interpret that in more detail next time. But since this is like the last 30 seconds, let me just note that this is in the massless case, this is a derivation of the famous redshifting effect. If I have a massless geodesic or the trajectory of a photon, then the energy, the momentum, the energy, and the frequency are all the same thing, and they fall off as 1 over a. So this explains why the when we look at the spectra of distant galaxies, frequencies are redshifted or appear lower. They're decaying with the expansion of the universe, and the expansion of the universe is directly observable. Okay. So that's it for today. Is there any questions before we break? Okay. I'll see you next time at 2:30.